Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone.
Good morning, folks. Mike Cosentino here. We're listening to Democratic Perspective, and we got a treat. Got a treat for me anyway. We're going to talk to Scott Thomas Anderson. He is a crime and courts reporter, which certainly is close to this ex-reporter's heart. He wrote a book called The Cutting Four Piece, and we'll talk about what that means, and we'll talk about the book. But first, we're going to say good morning, Scott Thomas Anderson.
Good morning.
All right, there you are. Scott is a California journalist. He's author of a couple of nonfiction books. One we're going to kind of drill into this morning, called The Cutting Four Piece, as I said. But he wrote a book called Shadow People, about meth addiction. Certainly not an unusual topic, unfortunately, in Northern Arizona. You can't pick up a local paper or listen to some of the local prosecutors without hearing about the groups and the special offices within the county attorney's office that are dedicated to meth prosecution. But we got, Scott Thomas Anderson is working at a Sacramento paper. He's working at the Sacramento News and Review. One of the things we're going to talk about this morning is literary journalism, a term that I am familiar with and fond of. Talk about a lot of Scott's work in, as a result of being a crime and courts reporter. Good morning, Scott Thomas Anderson. Let's jump right in here, if we don't mind. Let's talk about The Cutting Four Piece. What does that title mean?
Well, a four piece, it's prison lingo. A four piece is, ankle bracelets, handcuffs, and the center chain that connects the two. So anytime a defendant who's in custody is led into a courtroom, they'd be in what prisoners would call a four-piece.
I see. Well, and it sounds very comfortable.
Since the book's come out, a lot of people told me the title seems a little obscure, but I have to say a lot of folks who are in prison really love the title. So I guess it's a matter of knowing your audience.
Well, that's actually, I went through the exact same thought process. As I saw the title, I said, no. And then I read what it was, and you have it right on the title page and whatever, and I thought about it for a minute, and I said, yeah, maybe so. You know, it carries a lot, there's a lot behind it. So the inspiration, like you said, you are currently employed at the Sacramento News and Review. I get the name right?
Yeah, it's the big weekly newspaper around California's capital.
There you go. And a lot of your work is in and around Sacramento, and a lot of your subject matter is in and around Northern California.
Yeah, but I've traveled all over the country too for both books. I've done field work in 11 different states for them, so they definitely are written from a national perspective.
Right. And this book covers four states.
The Cutting Four Piece is focused on four states, yes.
I see. Well, tell us a little bit about the book. It's a fascinating book. I mean, my co-host is famous for this. He asks questions and then doesn't give the guest a chance to answer. I'm practicing that unique skill. But that this particular piece of literary journalism was compelling to read. I want to say this at the top of the show, that I'm reading Scott Thomas Anderson's nonfiction book called The Cutting Four Piece, and I'm a seasoned, somewhat critical reader. And I can't wait to finish it. So talk some more about the book.
Well, I've been a newspaper crime reporter for 11 years now, and what the public has a hard time getting access to is this reality that when you walk down the the sort of dark halls of the American justice system. You're walking through this interlocking maze where, you know, challenges with prison overcrowding, challenges with criminal thinking, challenges with addiction, challenges with treating mental illness, and especially policy born from politics are all sort of converging in a way that just paralyzes the system. And so what I wanted to do was to write a piece of journalism that would attempt to take people on a tour of that maze and in a way that really showed them the reality of how it looks on the streets.
That's excellent. And obviously the phrases there that caught me on Democratic perspective among all of those is politics involvement in policymaking. You talk about prison policy coming out of politics. What's that about?
Well, if you look at the crime trends over the last 30 years, we did have nationally a huge decrease in crime over the last 25, 30 years. But during that same period, we became the most jailing nation in the world. And so as crime levels came down, prison populations went up, up, up. And in the case of, say, like the federal prison system, federal prison population went up 37%, but the number of violent offenders that were in it was something like 7%. So we were moving in this political direction where we were, you know, incarceration was the first stop for trying to handle everything. And we've reached, many states now have reached a level of prison overcrowding that is, number one, financially unsustainable, but is also being found in state Supreme Courts and in the federal Supreme Court to be causing conditions that are unconstitutional for the inmates. So we're at a sort of crisis point, and we have been for about 8 or 9 years now. We just have a level of prison overcrowding in the nation that we can't afford to pay for and that we can't legally do anymore. So different states are trying different experiments with criminal justice to try to take a different approach that would put more emphasis on everything from preventative type programs with the youth to better rehabilitation programs, better addiction treatment programs. And every state is, you know, taking its own approach. But where the politics come into play are, you know, using this whole concept of victimization and politicizing it as a platform for various politicians. And it's not just Republicans that do this. Some Democrats do it too in some places. And so the whole conversation becomes so politicized that I think for your average member of the public, there's a wall up, a curtain, so to speak, that keeps them from seeing the reality of what's actually going on in courtrooms, what's actually going on prison yards, what's actually going on drug corners, because all they're hearing from are politicians that are presenting a certain narrative for a political reason.
One of the phrases from the books that I like is that the truth is in the streets. You live a lot closer to, I want to say a lot meaner life, but certainly a lot closer life than anybody I know to this subject matter, and that the truth is in the streets. It's certainly not going to be found in the courtroom, unfortunately, where we expect to find truth. Reading Scott Thomas Anderson's book, that's one of the things that you would learn. You did a great job, in my opinion, of reporting on this topic, on reporting on this interface between politically driven prison policy in your book. And I want to emphasize that you did a reporting job, not a hatchet job or a biased job. Now, don't get me wrong, it doesn't take the reader very long, I think, to form his or her own view of at least the one political policy that you take on and report on, and this is California realignment. Talk about that and how it works in your book, if you don't mind, because it was fascinating to see this one program that the intent, as you just said, has to happen. You know, we're talking about 2.2 million people the largest, like, in the world, and the other, the next 19 nations combined don't have that many people in prison. More than North Korea, if we actually knew how many North Korea had. I mean, these are the stats of the last, as you said, 8 or 9 years. So some of these statistics are a little old, but I'm pretty sure they're still holding. And unsustainable. So states have tried different things. Tell us about how, what happened to the people's lives that you report on because or have realigned.
Right. So for people who don't know, California had the worst level of prison overcrowding statewide in the nation. And it eventually, around 2009, there was a United States Supreme Court ruling that upheld a bunch of federal court rulings that had preceded that the inmates in the California prison system, their constitutional rights were being violated. The overcrowding had reached a level where they couldn't get basic mental and physical health care. And so there was an order by a federal panel of judges that for California had to reduce its prison population by thousands and thousands of inmates within a year. So there weren't, in defense of Governor Jerry Brown, there weren't a lot of great options in front of him. He didn't want to do just a mass prisoner release.
Right.
So what lawmakers in California did is they passed this program that was at the time Assembly Bill 109, but it's since been come to known more popularly as the Realignment Program. And what it did in theory was it transferred thousands of inmates for newly convicted crimes. So not the cohort of inmates that's already in state prison, but all the people that have committed real crime in real time and that are going through the court system in the present. It sends thousands of them to county jails for county prison terms in county jail rather than the state prison system.
I see.
And in that, when you factor in accelerated parole hearings and things like that, then the idea was to bring the state prison level down rapidly while you're building county jails and turning county jails into county prisons for a whole host of offenses. But the problem with it was that 90% of California's county jails were already operating at maximum capacity for people that were being held pretrial. So it physically couldn't be done. So they had to come up, the counties were forced to come up with all these alternative sentencing programs and alternative monitoring programs, that would essentially send a whole lot of people home, on ankle bracelets. And so they could make space for people doing these quote unquote county prison terms. So this is all being written at the California State Capitol by lawmakers, and many of the folks involved had little or no background with the criminal justice system. This was just being written in a desperation attempt. And so I think what a lot of critics of this program would say is, yes, there was a huge problem with overcrowding. Yes, we were not doing a good job of rehabilitating criminals. We were not doing a good job of taking criminals and creating an atmosphere and program that would allow them to have a normal life and rejoin society when they got out. And we certainly were failing with all of our attempts at drug addiction treatment. So all those things were true. And the aims of the program, I think there was general consensus that the aims of the program were the right aims. But then you have the reality, and what critics of the program would say is it was a matter of taking a broadsword to an ocular surgery instead of a scalpel. I mean, and you're talking this massive bill the size of, three phone books that the vast majority of California lawmakers didn't even read when they passed it.
Tell me about go ahead. Sorry.
So it goes into effect, and here's what any patrol officer or probation officer or even like street reporter like myself, or definitely any addict could have told you is, if we're talking about in the case of something like methamphetamine or if we're talking about rock cocaine, taking a bunch of people who are in custody waiting, trial and sending them home to eat Cheetos on an ankle monitor, well, the ankle monitor is nothing more than a piece of nylon and plastic to them if they want to get their blast on. I mean, and it's, by the way, it's only a misdemeanor to cut it off. So they don't even, there's really, and in a state where misdemeanors don't equal jail time anymore, there's basically no incentive to even keep the ankle monitor on. So I think what you had with this program was a fundamental lack of understanding reality around hardcore drug addiction. Right. And now for the addicts that are only doing drugs and that's all they're doing, it maybe that's not a big deal to a lot of people, but the reality is a huge percentage of the addicts are, you know, burglarizing homes, burglarizing vehicles. There's a ton of child abuse that goes on in these houses, a ton of elder abuse that goes on in these houses. I mean, if you live in courtrooms like I do, you will see that the vast majority of child abuse cases, child neglect, elder abuse, serial burglaries, assaults, a lot of domestic violence, all ties back to things like methamphetamine and raw cocaine.
Well, that's one of the things of the book. The victimization as the violence flowed into the prison, and then the prison culture flowed back into the streets, and leaving this trail of that Scott Thomas Anderson in his book did so very well, left this trail of victims. One after the other, like you said, whether they're old, whether they're young, whether they're children, whether they're wives, husbands, and the drugs are at the heart of it all. And one of the flaws in the system, one of the misjudgments, was the ankle bracelet idea. I mean, it doesn't take we're trying to deal with a medical problem here. And
a medical problem that becomes a criminal problem for other people. Yeah. And that's why it's so complicated. I think in California, we don't want to criminalize drug use itself. We do want to treat that as a public health crisis, but you can't be naive to the reality that with the drug use, for many addicts comes this whole list of other crimes that get perpetrated against communities and other people, and that's where the victimization comes in.
Can you talk about LEAP?
And that's the program didn't really acknowledge that. It wasn't built to acknowledge that reality, and it wasn't built to deal with that reality.
Can you talk about law enforcement against prohibition? Is that something that relates here?
Yeah, LEAP. LEAP is a national organization of current and former law enforcement people that are advocating for full legalization of drugs, including hardcore drugs. That's a very controversial proposition at the moment, though, because we don't have a lot of programs in effect that would control the crime aspect of doing that. But the point that LEAP makes is, I think a lot of members of LEAPs are former prosecutors.
Yes.
And the point they make is, you know, that it's true. The point they're making is true. I mean, I work drug corners. I work gang neighborhoods. I'm a street reporter in them. I can't deny the point they're making. The point they're making is, you know, you clear one drug corner and all you've done is created a job for the next drug dealer who's going to recruit his cohort of teenagers to sling his product. And it's just sticking your thumb in cracks in the dam, and it doesn't do anything but inflate the jail population, inflate the prison population. That's true. But I do also see the other side of the argument that a lot of law enforcement folks who work the streets would tell you, in terms of trying to just do basic crime containment, that if you were to do a full legalization across the board without a huge, massive investment into preventative programs, better health care, better mental health treatment services, that, you know, the crime level against your average citizen would go up, up, up if you didn't make those investments way ahead of time. And we're not making those investments.
I see. So LEAP's got a great idea, and certainly from the citizens' standpoint, you know, if we were sitting around at a cocktail party, they would say something similar to what you said about squash it on one corner and it pops up on another. We see this, and so this group of former prosecutors and cops' wives and cops and former cops got together and said, hey, here's a solution. Legalize it and then control it. But Scott Thomas Anderson, you know, stepping back and saying, yeah, okay, there's a point there, but without this other investment in how to care for these folks. As people have heard on this show before, that the L.A. County Jail is the largest mental health facility in the country. And then somebody said, looked at me like I was crazy because, yeah, well, of course, the Yavapai County Jail, the county that the show is coming from, it's the largest mental health facility in this part of the country. So, this is what we do to our folks with, those problems. We lock them up.
Right. And so one of the other largest healthcare facilities in the nation is the Cook County Jail in Illinois. And the sheriff of Cook County, Thomas Dart, has actually been a really great national leader on trying to convince Congress on the federal level and convince state legislators to make big investments up front on better mental health services because it will lower crime. Not only is it a humane thing to do to get better treatment to people who need it, but it will lower crime. And Thomas Dart's been in hearings in Congress talking about all these different people that come through his jail usually for pretty minor offenses that are completely explainable and attributable to them having severe schizophrenia, or severe manic bipolar. Something that nobody's going to dispute is mental illness. Yeah, and he's operating, as you say, one of the largest mental health treatment facilities in the nation.
That's good to know. I want to talk about Scott Thomas, and I want to talk about you for a little while. But first, because we're doing this show from Arizona, let's talk about private prisons. Arizona is, we had an administration. Jan Brewer, all her aides were private prison advocates, if not on the boards of private prisons. Correction Corporations of America has, last count, six federal prisons in Arizona, and they've taken over some state ones, or at least private prisons have. So, please, we would love to hear from you. You're the closest thing we have to an expert, at least now. Tell us about private prisons.
Yeah, you know, as a journalist, you know, we're always trying to be objective, but I think I see the private prison industry as the most disturbing development in the last 30 years in the United States. And it came into being in the wake of the state and federal prisons reaching this epic level of overcrowding across the U.S. And with that came the rise of the private for-profit prison industry, which literally takes imprisoned human beings and turns them into commodities for Wall Street. I mean, years ago, when people used to talk about the prison industrial complex, they were talking about prison, top-heavy bureaucracies and sort of cash-flush guard unions. Well, I would argue that those threats are nothing compared to this alternative universe that's grown up around the private prison industry. Now, at the end of the day, state prisons, county jails, they are answerable to elected officials who are answerable to the public. The private prison industry is answerable to nobody but their corporate shareholders, their shareholders. Yep. That's the only people they answer to. And the reality is for them, more crime equals more customers. The more people who are victimized, the more families that are torn apart by having a loved one go to prison, the higher their profits go. And we now know these corporations have been using money to influence lawmakers, both through direct campaign contributions and through the American Legislative Exchange Council. When you step back and especially with everything that's gone on this year, around the violence and protests around things like Confederate statues and just the haunting shadow of Jim Crow and the Civil War. But here we have lawmakers in Washington, D.C. and in many of our state capitals that are perfectly willing to do business with an industry that is as close to legal slavery as you're going to find.
Exactly. And that's exactly the comparison I want to make. I mean, this whole private prison thing, Scott, and as I listen to you talk about it and as I've talked about it before, it is so huge. It's not the kind of thing that you can just dismiss. It's like slavery in that It's such a big issue. You know, the idea of buying and selling human beings, the idea of having your children sold out. I mean, as a teacher, you try to drive home the true impact, the true nature of slavery. It's the same thing with private, the nature of turning people into commodities, as you said, what kind of mind? We talk about criminal thinking in your book. We're talking about Wall Street thinking. What kind of mind could conceive, said, hey, we got prison overcrowded. We can make some money on this.
I'll give you a great example of Wall Street thinking and how it factors into the private prisons. In 2012, a federal judge in Mississippi found GEO Group, which is among the top three private prison industries, companies in the United States, a federal judge in Mississippi found them guilty of what he described as crimes against humanity involving juvenile offenders in one of their facilities. So what does that mean? That means they hire gang members, known gang members, to be their quote-unquote correctional officers. How bad their background checks are. That is this idea of, like, fast food employees as peace officers, because that's how you make money. You don't pay what you would pay a professional peace officer, professional correctional officer. You don't give them those kinds of benefits, retirement, middle class pay. No, you get people to work for a lot less, and you do background checks of letting gang members, of letting people with pimping backgrounds, and that just let in people that have no business working in anything resembling a peace officer position.
Right.
And that's how that came to pass in Mississippi. But guess what? When we talk about who is answerable here, when that came down, the United States Justice Department, federal judge in Mississippi, fined GEO Group guilty of all those things. The only repercussion is that GEO Group loses its contract with the state of Mississippi.
Wow.
There are still 15 other states doing business with them, and they have three facilities in Arizona.
And so they commit crimes against humanity, and they have three facilities in Arizona. I want to repeat that. And their punishment is to shut the one, to lose the contract, lose one contract.
That's their punishment.
Scott,
they lose the contract.
Scott Thomas Anderson is the author of a fine book called The Cutting Four Piece on prison overcrowding and the tragedies that stem from that. The subtitle, I want to make sure I get the subtitle right, because as usual, subtitles are Crime and Tragedy in an Era of Prison Overcrowding. But obviously, we can talk about this subject for many shows, but I want to talk about the author, since I got him on the line here. Scott Thomas Anderson has a more of a life. He's a travel reporter. He wrote 112 stories for the paper he works for, the Sacramento News and Review, up there in the capital of California, in beautiful Northern California. And he travels around Northern California. He wasn't, as he was facing all this misery in the crimes and courts of the Sacramento area, he also did some traveling around and did some writing about it, as a writer does. And so as far as if you're interested in, part of what we do here is, sell stuff, Scott Thomas Anderson has a book, The Shadow People. Like I said, I'm going to recommend it to Sheila Polk, Yavapai County Attorney, and all of her deputy county's attorney. You should read the book if you haven't already. The Meth Task Force that formed, you probably should read the book without a doubt. And you should read The Cutting Four Piece. They should be on the required reading list for our county prosecutors. But one of the things that Scott also talks about, which is close to my heart, and that's what has happened to journalism, and what's you did a talk somewhere in California at a bookstore, probably, that the English language in the digital age. So we're going to hopefully the gears won't grind as we shift here. Talking about the media metamorphosis that continues. I mean, it's 2017 and it's still happening, and how Americans share their everyday experiences. Don't let me hold you back here. Talk about your ideas on the changed journalistic landscape and the whole digital age thing.
Well, the changes in the journalistic landscape are pretty well documented. I'd be shocked if people haven't seen or heard about how bad they've been. We've had a near industry collapse during the recession, and a ton of very good, experienced reporters either lost their jobs or were basically forced to take buyouts all over the United States. We've seen some newspapers close. We've seen others get, you know, smaller community papers, which are vitally important, get bought up by bigger companies, gutted, and they're just sort of a shell of themselves to make money off, you know, legal notices and things like that. So the newspaper industry has gone through this tectonic shift, and there's a huge consequence to the American people from it, because newspapers, reporters were always the frontline investigators in the media landscape, always. And anyone who works in television or radio will probably tell you that most of the TV and radio news that's hard-hitting and in-depth, it originates from newspaper reporting. You
that's
know,
right.
Newspaper reporters that have been doing embedded work, newspaper reporters that are getting in deep into something and following it for months at a time or years at a time, writing story after story, building this deep institutional knowledge around a subject matter and in constantly investigating. And so when you lose a bunch of people with that skill set, and fewer and fewer things get investigated, it's real simple. It's just basic arithmetic.
So how should we get our information in the digital age? What can the consumer do?
Well, there's this whole other issue, too, that's going on where as we see the rise of technology affecting our daily communication habits, we're seeing everybody. It's not just young people, but everybody sort of being reconditioned to to communicate, speak, write in these sort of hyper-abbreviated ways. And I think there's a real danger that just the art of writing and the art of communicating intelligent thought through artistic, creative, ambitious writing could be lost if people aren't aware that this is happening to us. I would say that, you know, every day we live in a world where every day we're basically being more and more hardwired into this landscape, you know, into this sort of cocoon of, you know, technological hyperspeed, and that's affecting how we communicate with each other. You know, Twitter, Snapchat, bullet blurbs, texting. I mean, when you condition yourself to write in the simplest terms and start replacing, you know, very thought-provoking and transporting words with emojis and symbols and things like that, that's going to have a social consequence. And I just think people need to recognize that so there can be a push to find a balance to it.
Yeah, I'm doing that. I refuse to do anything in sound bites anymore. People always want the bottom line, and I said, no, if you haven't got enough time for me to spend a few sentences on it, then let's talk about the weather or something else. One of the other things I want to get to in our Scott Thomas Anderson's interview here, they're talking about his books, The Cutting Four Piece and The Shadow People, but you did a workshop on literary journalism. We're talking about the genre of literary journalism, a wonderful, and you called that workshop, or somebody did, Wolf at the Door, a workshop on literary journalism. In this case, the wolf that you're referring to is Thomas Wolfe, and certainly men or women of a certain age. I remember Thomas Wolfe and the Kool-Aid Acid Test and all of that type of reporting. So would you talk about that for a minute?
Well, I believe I'm very lucky that I get to work for a publication that embraces literary journalism, which is, for folks who aren't familiar with the term, it's a style of creative nonfiction where in literary journalism what we do is we use all the standards, all the factual reporting standards that any newspaper would use to report news stories, but we have the freedom to use the kind of writing style and the kind of literary devices that are used in novels and short stories to make the reporting, to make the investigation resonate on a more human level, and just try to capture what's powerful about it on a human level through ambitious writing. So it's not the kind of codified writing that you see in daily newspapers. It's just a style that reads more like short stories and novels, but everything, as long as the person's doing their job, the reporting, the story is 100% factual. The words, the quotes, everything's exactly what happened.
The icons that people will remember are certainly the ones I remember: Truman Capote, Hunter S. Thompson, Tom Wolfe, as we said. And we're going to throw Scott Thomas Anderson in there as young and mid-career as he is.
You just named a bunch. There's a great tradition in the United States that goes back to World War II with Ernie Pyle, who's one of my heroes.
Exactly.
And over the years, there's all the folks you mentioned. There's people like Jimmy Breslin in New York, people like David Simon and John Franklin in Baltimore. There's just been a tradition that's gone all the way up from the 1940s to the present day. Literary journalism's never gone away. The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair have always at least had some stories that fit this model, and there's still a lot of great writers. And what we see going to national journalism conferences is the style is still very popular with the public. There's no question about it. Survey after survey after survey done around the United States that people who are into reading news and features around current events really gravitate towards that approach.
It's a perfect kind of art. They may not know what it is, but they know that they like it.
That's a good way to put it.
You know, if they want some more of literary journalism from Scott Thomas Anderson, is there any way they can get it? Are you doing anything with this other than writing it and your job at the Sacramento News and Review? You did teach this workshop once, but that was a long time ago. Are you doing anything else with this online, and can they get to you? How can they get to if we've whetted their appetite for Scott Thomas Anderson and some of his writing, whether it's his books or his newspaper or his reporting? You got a website?
Yeah, it's just www.scottthomasanderson.com, and that has a bunch of my bigger literary journalism reports that you can read for free without a paywall. There's a bunch of stuff on that website, and it'll get updated in a couple months with a lot of new content. I also have a journalism Facebook page, which is just, you find it on Facebook, just Scott Thomas Anderson, author. And I post a lot of links to big literary journalism pieces that I do on there as well.
I want to say this is a guy that did a Kickstarter. And I thought, well, okay, he's doing this for money because journalists like are underpaid guys. No. He raised $3,600 to give copies of his book to nonprofits, and that is how important it is. And that it tells such a compelling story about in this literary journalistic style about these people involved, the cops involved, the detectives involved, the victims involved, the meth people involved, the families involved in these stories that suffered in the process of the criminal justice system and its errors and missteps along the way. So once again, I can't say it often, the Cutting Four piece, Scott Thomas Anderson is here. I do want to take him. His own paper wrote a great review of the book. Other people picked up some reviews. I believe all they will do is make you want to, before I go to my book group, if I haven't read the book, I find a New York Times review or something, and then I don't have to have read the book and I can sound intelligent. Now, these reviews will make you want to read the book as they should. But we're going to take, since I'm babbling, we're going to take a minute and say thank you to Democrats of the Red Rocks for their support. We want to remind you of their Thursday breakfasts with their speakers over at the Old Sedona Bar and Grill. This is October, so we got a breakfast coming up in a couple of weeks. Keep your eye out for that. We want to thank Steve Segner and his crew over at El Portal, where I'll be for breakfast in about 15 minutes. And if you want to come over and give me money, call me names, just don't shoot me, that'll be fine. Steve Segner and his crew over there are great supporters of Democratic Perspective. We want to remind you that you can get this show and all our shows, all our podcasts, at vvid.org. Vvid.org will have this show in a couple of days by the time we get it up. and all our old shows. Talking to Scott Thomas Anderson from Sacramento, the author, has a Facebook page and a web page with some great literary journalism on it. The book that I've been reading and we are talking mostly about his most recent book, published just in 2015, but The Cutting Four-Piece, Crime and Tragedy in an Era of Prison Overcrowding. In Arizona, with our private prisons and our the prosecuting mania, we spend three times as much on prisoners here as we do on students, which I guess tells you the priorities of Arizonans. I'm not sure that it's the priorities of Arizonans as much as it is the priorities of the Republican legislature. Scott did point out, we bash Republicans on this show, but one of the reasons the owner sits across here and hasn't thrown us out is because we're pretty middle of the road. Where the Democrats need to be slapped, we slap them occasionally. And this is one of those things that's, although we did mention ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is in part brought Arizona and, as Scott just said, 14 other states, private prisons. It's a mostly Republican thing, but it does have some Democrats hanging around.
Mm-hmm. All right. You will find members of both parties that have really politicized the whole issue of crime in order for their personal gain. I mean, it's not limited to one party.
So tell us about some of these cops. One of the beautiful things that you do, and I want to get back to the Cutting Four piece, since that was kind of the central of focus of this particular show. Obviously, this subject, the amount of tragedy, the amount of devastation that it does to families, and we haven't touched on that, and it's one of the things that Scott Thomas Anderson does so well in his book, and so we're going to touch on it now. Tell us about, I know there's not a lot of time left, there's, we got 3 or 4 minutes, but, I was looking at, we talked about LEAP, from the book, and he talks about that, but you got a couple of cops in here, a couple of detectives, Crabtree and Serpa?
Mm-hmm.
We got a minute.
They're in Calaveras County in California, which if you have any literature fans, is where Mark Twain's The yes. Jumping Frog of Calaveras County was set. It's a beautiful old ranching community in the gold country of California, but it's been stricken with this endemic rural poverty, and it has a huge meth epidemic that's just choking the community up, and it's been that way for years. Like, I actually used to cover that community as a reporter.
And what would Mark Twain say if he was there?
I mean, I think it's if you go back and read, he wrote about it in Roughing It and some of his other stories, and the irony is it's parts of it have become so impoverished and cut off from services and the mainstream community that they've there's the northeastern part of the county is sometimes referred to as Meth Mountain, and in an ironic way it's just as sort of lawless as it was when Twain was there, or maybe that's an exaggeration, but it's definitely arcing back in that direction, because the county doesn't have money to get the kind of law enforcement resources and mental health resources and public health resources and transportation and all the things it would take to sort of better integrate that community into mainstream society. So it just becomes this deep, isolated, rural outlier where a lot of bad things happen.
Well, that's it. I wanted to give you a sense of place where Scott Thomas Anderson is coming from, at least as far as writing goes. We got a great reporter from the San Francisco News and Review. Please catch him, catch his stuff. Go to his Facebook page. We want to catch you to catch our stuff at vvid.org. vvid.org. Thanks, folks. Talk to you soon.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news and our Saturday replay after the noon news right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.